RM suffered our own influenza pandemic. It was the kind of virus that goes right to your lungs, they say, and boy, does it ever. So we closed the offices here, and for a week, very little went on. We simply had a lot of prayer for a lot of people who were sick, maybe a dozen who were out. Local brethren and children who suffered from this most potent flu strain that I've ever seen. We didn't have Wednesday work night, and the only really thing that got done was that volunteer Debbie was here on Tuesday and got some mail processed. So we're glad of that. At least it wasn't a completely lost week. And the good news is that those who are here, at least, are on the mend. We still have a number who are out. Well, no one with a complete set of brain chromosomes wants to deliberately get sick. I don't mind once in a while, I guess, because I have a chance to lose a little weight. But I hate to see when the children get sick, and that really hurts. And you see them just suffering, the little ones. But you know, there are other advantages to being sick and to getting sick. When you're under attack physically, it has something to do with you as far as humility goes. We immediately think of Job. We think of what he went through. In Job chapter 1, we have the patriarch being described. There was a man in the land of Uz. They say this is where Wizard of Oz gets its name. But anyway, whose name was Job, and that man was perfect and upright, and one that feared Elohim and eschewed evil. And there were born unto him 7 sons and 3 daughters. His substance also, and it goes through how rich a man he was. But we notice first off that he's a man that did what was right, and he's called upright. Wouldn't mind having my name in the Bible attached to the word upright, would you? What an honor. But here he is, and he is doing well, thank you. Now in verse 6, there was a day when the sons of Elohim came to present themselves before Yahweh, and of course, Satan, as per usual, is there among them. And Yahweh said unto Satan, "Where'd you come from?" And Satan answered Yahweh, verse 7, and said, "From going to and fro in the earth, from walking up and down in it." And Yahweh said unto Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him in the earth, a perfect and upright man, one that fears Elohim and eschews evil?" Even the Father in heaven would say such things about him. He must have been quite a man. And Satan says, "Well, yeah, that's fine as long as you've got a hedge around him, as long as you're protecting him. I can see why he would be that way, but take away that protection and then see what happens." Yahweh says, "Okay, go ahead, but don't kill him." Now, what's interesting about this is that Job doesn't know what's going on. He's not privy to these behind-the-scenes happenings that took place. And he just all of a sudden gets hit, bang, 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 one thing after another. That is a very important key to this whole book. What's the meaning of Job? Some say, well, the man was self-righteous. Well, he might have been a little bit, but I don't think that's at the core of what it's really all about. The simple fact that when we suffer innocently, there sometimes could be a purpose behind it that we don't see, we don't understand, we don't know, but it's there. Sometimes it's just a test to see if we will remain faithful and honor Yahweh through thick and thin. Also, when we get ill or when we suffer trials, we get a lesson in perspective about what's really important in life and what isn't. And there's something about really drawing you down to nothing that gets your heart turned around real fast. You find out what really matters in life. You plead for Yahweh to intervene because that's all you care about right now is to get well again, because you cannot stand to keep on going like this. Human nature likes to focus on the trials and the bad things and to quickly forget all the blessings, not the least of which is life itself and our opportunity to live in such a way that Yahweh one day may find us worthy to be taken and rule with him in the kingdom. Think about it. You know, when we get married, we're out there, you know, guys are fishing. They don't know who might be their mate, and they try to find someone who's, you know, compatible in many different ways. And you search from one, you search for the other, and maybe if you're blessed, you'll find one. But Yahweh is, right now, got an advantage over us for that reason. He is actually making his bride. He's refining his bride right now. He is preparing a people to be in his very family. And that's what we're all about. We're learning how to be a part of his family. And the issue many have with obeying Yahweh is really, we talked about that at the Bible study today. The common belief is, well, Yahshua did it all, he paid it all, and he's all in all, and all we have to do is look to him. Well, we do look to him as the author of salvation, certainly. But the issue is a little deeper than what most people think. They think, well, you know, we're justified, so that's all we need to worry about. Well, justification simply means just as if you had never sinned. And that's the point where Yahweh has to put us, because all of us have sinned. And there's no way we can get around that. We're all guilty, judged and convicted guilty. We can't earn it. We can't, you know, anything that we do can't get us, you know, farther up the ladder. It's all in Yahweh's providence. And we know that. But sanctification is a different term. The Bible talks about being sanctified, set apart. Sanctification is altogether different. It's how we live. Justification is right standing before Yahweh. Sanctification is how we live before him. And that is where the refining comes in. Putting it differently, sanctification is how we live and how Yahweh can use us. Justification just puts us into his presence by his grace. And therein lies the great understanding, and misunderstanding, I should say. It is much harder spiritually for the average person to live uprightly today than it has been, I believe, in centuries past. Well, yeah, we might have more freedom to do that today, in at least in our nation. But the point is, we've got the whole world against it. You know, back in the days of Sodom and Gomorrah, you had a sin that was pretty much localized in that area. Now we've got that sin all over the world. Just one example. And we have to fight the whole culture to not only walk as Yahweh would have us walk, but also teach. And it's so difficult because not only is there a bias against Yahweh's word, but there's a bias against the understanding that we have, as far as the culture and as far as the history has gone, and tradition has been working at it for 2,000 years and against the truth. So there's a difficulty. I believe one more generation of the majority thinking will be that the Bible is just one man's historical opinion. You've got public schools working against the faith. You've got the media against it, certainly, every chance they get. You got the courts ruling against it. You got Hollywood working to destroy it and making anybody of faith a bumblehead. It's only got half his marbles. All of the major public influences are in a barrage against the truth. You know, our problems in this world are not politics. You know, we're into the throes of the political thing right now. Just one thing after another. Charge and countercharge, and, well, I'm going to make change and all that. That isn't where our problems lie. Our problems are spiritual. We're in a spiritual war, and Yahweh's people are slowly but surely being left standing alone at the front lines as the rest are shrinking back because of the power of the evil one at this time. Are we strong enough spiritually, I guess, is the question. And Yahweh says, I will make you strong spiritually if you will overcome the trials that are set before you. Just as he said with Job, you know, Go ahead and try him. See what kind of metal he's made of. And see what you can do, evil one. And so here we go. Job suffered one thing after another. The most trials and tribulations of anyone on this planet, probably, except maybe Yahshua himself. You know, we really, and I look at this book, and I remember one time we had a question, a course I took, and they said, what is the issue with Job? What is, boil down to the essence, what is Job about? And we had to write an essay on it. I believe one of the biggest messages of this book is the fact that people ask, why did this happen to me? Why are these bad things happen to me? And unless we ask that question or answer that question every time a good thing happens, we have no right to ask the question. We don't have any right to ask the question. And that's what we find at the very end of this book in chapter 40 and verse 6. We've got Job and his three friends going round and round. Why all these things are happening to you? And his three friends sometimes give him right counsel, sometimes they don't. And finally, Yahweh comes into the scene and says, look. Chapter 40, verse 6. Then answered Yahweh unto Job out of the whirlwind and said, get up, gird up your loins now like a man. I will demand of you and declare you unto me. I'm going to ask you and you answer me. Will you also disannul my judgment? Will you condemn me that you may be righteous? Have you an arm like Elohim, or can you thunder the voices like him? Deck yourself now with majesty and excellency and array yourself with glory and beauty. Cast abroad the rage of your wrath and behold every one that is proud and abase him. Look on every one that is proud and bring him low and tread down the wicked out of their place. Hide them in the dust together and bind their faces in secret. Then will I also confess unto you that you, your own right hand, can save you. If you can do all these things, then you can do anything, including save yourself. Then he goes on and compares the different magnificent aspects of creation and says, who can make something like this? Who can do this? He said, one of verse 41, can you draw out Leviathan with the hook or his tongue with a cord which you let down? Can you put a hook in his nose or bore his jaw through with the thorn? You know, there's, of course, the common thinking is that the dinosaurs were long before man, millions and millions and billions of years before man. Here we have something called Leviathan, and he says, can you hook him? Can you put something in his nose? Could it be that these were talking about monster creatures that everybody thought was extinct and gone? Well, he says, goes on, verse 7, can you fill his skin with barbed irons and or his head with fish spears? And then he goes on and then he says, who can open doors of his face? His teeth are terrible round about. And all of these things, we look at creation, we look at Yahweh, and we say, who are we? Who is man? Who is man? He says, hear, I beseech you, and I will speak. I will demand of you and declare you unto me. I have heard of you by the hearing of the ear. I'm in verse 5 of chapter 42. This is Job speaking. But now my eye sees you. Wherefore I abhor myself and repent in dust and ashes. I think one of the lessons of Job is the magnificence of Yahweh and the total puniness, the total insignificance of man. And what right do we have to ask anything of Yahweh and blaspheme him by saying, why are you allowing this to happen to me? I think that's the answer in Job. We don't have any right. Without him, we wouldn't even be here in the first place. And all that went through Job's mind, he never questioned Yahweh. He didn't even know what was going on. Now, if he had known what was going on before all this happened, this little interchange between Satan and Yahweh, it would have made a lot of big difference, wouldn't it? It would make a pretty big difference in his response and in his understanding of why he's going through this. Oh, I can see now, and I'm being tested by this way, and okay. But the fact that he didn't know, that's the key. He didn't know. When we don't know, then the true us comes out. If he had said, well, you know, I know what's happening, and I know the whole plan, then it makes it a whole different aspect of understanding of what why we go through trials. But when we understand that sometimes trials just happen to see what is inside of us, then we have a different perspective. So his suffering, that all that he went through, he lost his children, but then he, at the end, got everything back, it seems. He got a whole new set of, whole new family, and we understand the context. We get to see it, and we get to watch it, and we get to see Job going through these problems. And then we can see how is what he's going through compared to what I go through. How does it compare? Because we can't always see behind the scenes. We can't always see the problems other people are having, and then we look at it only from our perspective. And that is what makes our plight so hard to manage at times. We're blinded. We don't have all the answers. If you could know that your present trial would be over in 2 weeks, make it a little easier to get through it, wouldn't it? Maybe you're suffering from something serious. You could much more easily handle it. However, we don't always know. We don't always understand. So we ask why. And there's bigger struggles going on. So what if we could know exactly when the end will come? When Yahshua's going to return. What if we could know that? What if we could see the final outcome, the promised blessing that would be ours if we remain true to Yahweh and persevere? I think there'd be a lot fewer people just giving up, saying, I can't do this anymore. I can't go through this anymore. And they kind of drift off. Different parables Yahshua taught explains that. In 1 Corinthians chapter 2, and I often look at this as kind of a really encouragement when you're deep down in trial and tribulation and you just wonder, you know, is there any end in sight? And you look at 2 Corinthians 2 and verse 9 and what Paul said, some of the most beautiful words in the Scriptures. It is written, eye has not seen nor ear heard. Neither has it entered into the heart of man the things which Yahweh has prepared for them that love him. Now you got a little turtle in a box, and he's, you know, fidgeting around there trying to live, you know, and he's knocking his little self against the sides and always gets stuck and gets in the water and can't get out, and he's all inside this little box. This is his home. This is his life. He can't see the greater earth beyond him. If he could, it would put his life in a lot different perspective, wouldn't it? We can't see. Eye does not always understand the human eye and the mind, what Yahweh is in store for those that love him. We look out and we see these vast planets, and by the way, they say a meteor is about to go by the earth. I think it's next week, almost as close as the moon. You know, just one little sidetrack and boom, this would be it. If Yahweh so desired. But anyway, we look at our vast universe and we see all the magnificence of it. We look at that and we say, you know, there's some purpose behind this. Maybe someday I'll be out there. Maybe someday I will have a planet to rule, a planet to develop, just as Yahshua did. Who knows? He says he doesn't create anything in vain. And that, anyway, Paul says, the eye does not see nor the ear hear what Yahweh has planned for those that love him, for his bride. It's a magnificent feature ahead of us. And yet we can't we can't grasp it. We can only see a little bit darkly. One day, maybe, it'll all be opened up to us. And we'll see, man, you know, it was all worth it. Those little trials we had back then, I was pretty sick a week ago. I've almost forgot about it now. It's amazing. Back then, I thought, I'll never forget this. But that's what happens with us. We forget. We don't have an eye that's always attuned and always open. One of our major weaknesses is our lack of foresight. We know the blessings await those who overcome, and yet still we get caught up and we question, we wonder, how come and why, and I can't handle this, and please take me out of this mess. And Job never said that. His wife told him so. Go ahead, just curse Yahweh and die. He wouldn't do it. She thought, well, just end it all. He had some kind of vision somewhere where he must have known there's something greater going on. But he didn't know what. I believe we are under routine satanic attack. And this is always the case, it seems, especially before times like Passover. We're tried, and Yahweh knows that these are tests. And he allows us to go through them like Job. And he's in effect accusing before Yahweh, saying, will John Doe make it? Will Sally remain true to you? And in certain cases, saying, I will overthrow his or her faith. Just watch me. And Yahweh gives him that go-ahead to try. Let us see what stuff they're made of. Let's see. Let's see how far they can go. See if they will continue on to the end of their walk. You know, a large part of our journey here, this narrow way, is overcoming sin and our own doubts. We have lots of doubts all the time. Remember that a bend in the way doesn't mean an end. It's just a turning point. It's just a trial. Worse things have happened. Our trials aren't terminal. They may seem so at the time. You know, we get all caught up in ourselves. But you know, someone once said, if you got a broken neck, nothing to eat, and your house is on fire, then you've got problems. Otherwise, you just got some inconveniences. And for the true worshiper, problems will ultimately work out to the glory of Yahweh. Well, we read in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, chapter 10 and verse 13, there has no temptation taken you, but such as is common to man. There's nothing that we go through in this life that hasn't been gone through before by somebody, and probably many people at different times in history. But Elohim is faithful, who will not suffer you to be tempted above that you are able, but with the temptation make a way to escape, that you may be able to bear it. That you may be able to bear it. Wherefore, he says, flee from idolatry. Flee from anything that comes between you and Yahweh. You might even be brought up to the brink of your breaking point, just so that Yahweh can learn just how far he can go. Why? Because Yahweh's going to use you someday. You're going to be in a rulership position. That's what he says. We'll talk about that toward the end. He wants to know how he can, you know, I can't imagine Alexander the Great going out with his huge armies and attacking, you know, some country without knowing the stuff that's in his generals. Can I trust them? How far will they go? Do they have what it takes? Will they go through the battle with the rest of them? Yahweh uses these things to see, can I use that individual for my purpose? Will they show that they're totally dedicated to me, and will continue on no matter what? I need to know. And sometimes you just don't know until you get in actually and do it. When I was going to school, one summer I worked with the Kansas Highway Department in the engineering division, and we were testing concrete on bridge overpasses. You know, those columns that hold it up, big, massive columns, to test to see if those things were going to hold up. And so they had a little lab there, and what they did was They didn't go out there with calculators and stand around and look at the thing and, you know, measure it and say, yeah, take a little hammer and chip on it and say, I think it'll work. It'll probably take a few tons. No. What we did is we took the same concrete and made little columns, like pencils, and did the same thing, same formula and everything that the regular concrete was going to have. And then when it was hardened, they apply pressure to it. They put in some machine and they can measure how much, you know, square inches of pressure that those columns would take. And then they could extrapolate that into the big column and say, this is, you know, this is actually how much stress that's going to take. This is a real world test. And so they did. You can make all sorts of projections and studies, and you can subject something to unlimited number of virtual scenarios and computer models, but until you actually put it through a real-life test, you're not going to know. And that's what we are in when we're suffering trials and tribulations. We're in a real-life test. And Yahweh uses these tests to find out how much pressure can they handle without breaking, without turning, and without giving up. Do we have the right stuff? We're in training for the kingdom. We're in boot camp. Rigorous training for a very demanding, highly responsible position, more than anything conceived by man. Because who knows what's after that? Who knows? Let's say Yahweh sends you out to a certain area, maybe populates a planet that's sitting there waiting to be populated. And then maybe he'll have you do something else, greater and greater responsibility. We don't know, but Yahweh's going to use us. We don't just sit around, you know, on clouds and play harps and look at each other's wings. There's a lot more about it than that. That's something they never taught me when I was growing up. What comes after this life? What's it for? We never got beyond that point. All they want to do is get in the door, and that's the end of that. Well, Yahweh has a greater mission for all of his people who will prove faithful to him. Revelation chapter 2:26, I remember in Sunday school, bringing us up to the teacher. I was a young kid just learning, and I thought I really had something, so I said, well, what about this? What about Revelation 2:26? And he that overcomes and keeps my works unto the end, to him will I give power over the nations. Teacher looked at me and, That's all he could say. I don't know if you ever read that verse. And then we turn to Revelation 5:10. And has made us unto our Elohim kings and priests, and we shall reign on the earth. Oh, on the earth. Never thought about that either. The millennium is going to be here on earth, not up in the sky somewhere. It's going to be served right here on earth, as this earth is going to be cleaned up and prepared one day after that time when Yahweh himself is going to come down in the New Jerusalem and reign right here on earth. This is going to be the capital of the universe, if you think about it that way. As far as we know, at least until another plan is initiated. Well, I want to turn to Luke chapter 22. Because during that millennial period, there's going to be a lot of activity going on this earth. And in Luke 22, verse 24, we learn a little about it. Joshua here is explaining again, as he always did, to his disciples gathered around him, what the plan really is all about. And they were fascinated by it, as we all would be. You know, this is the truth right in front of you speaking. This is how it's going to be. So tell me about it. Chapter 22 and verse 24. Now, this is interesting because we just got done the Passover. Just got done with the Passover. Think about this in context. And they had all kept it there, and they had the emblems and so forth. Now notice, verse 24, if they're all done, there was also strife among them. Which of them should be accounted the greatest? They just kept Passover. The most important right of all, and now they're fighting already. It just boggles your mind how humans are. And he said unto them, the kings of the Gentiles exercise rulership over them, and they that exercise authority upon them are called benefactors. But you, with you, you say shall not be so. But he that is greatest among you, let him be as the younger, and he that is chief as he that serves. For whether is greater, he that sits at meat or he that serves? Or is it not he that sits at meat? But I am among you as he that serves. And then we can skip. Well, let's keep on going here to verse 28. And you are they which have continued with me in your temptations. And I appoint unto you a kingdom as my Father has appointed unto me. So Yahweh sets up Yahshua as the king of this millennial system. He then chooses those that he wants under him. So that's how it's going to be. And he is going to choose those among his bride who have shown worthy through their life that they were dedicated to him and that they could serve him now, and they have proved themselves as dedicated to serving and worshiping, honoring him. So he says, I appoint you as rulers in my kingdom. You may eat at my table and sit on the 12 thrones. Let's go to chapter 22, and let's look at verse 31. Yahweh said, Peter, Peter, Shimon, Shimon, behold, Satan has desired to have you that he may sift you as wheat. Why is he saying that? He says that you may, verse 30, that you may eat and drink at my table in my kingdom and sit on the thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. And then he says, but Peter, you've got some issues here. But I have prayed for you that your faith fail not, and that when you are converted, strengthen your brethren. And that's exactly what happened. Remember when Peter got the Spirit? Peter turned into a completely different person. Completely different person. Whereas he was always going around, you know, questioning things and saying he'll do this and that and this and that. And he couldn't handle it all. Now he's mature and he's very focused. And he says, when you get that way, strengthen your brethren. Make them that way too. And he said unto him, Master, I am ready to go with you both into prison and to death. And he said, I tell you, Peter, the cock shall not crow this day before that thou shalt three times deny me. See, there again, he was impetuous and saying things that he wasn't able. You know, his mouth was operating, and his will couldn't back it up. But eventually, he did. He was very given the strength of the Spirit so that he could understand and actually be a real leader is what happened. Satan likes to sift you like wheat, he says. Notice it isn't chaff, it's wheat. Satan wants the prize. He wants you. He wants the grain that is produced. And Peter wasn't really totally converted at this point. And no wonder if he made his famous blunder in verse 33, and simply because he wasn't ready. When he says, I'm ready to go with you and into prison and death, and Yahshua says, you can't even handle saying you were with me. You're going to deny me three times, let alone do all these other magnanimous things. You know, so many people, and this is the constant story we hear, the constant refrain of evangelists all over the place, that they believe that as soon as they accept Yahweh, as they say, and JC, their life becomes an instant success. Cornucopia everywhere, goodness and wealth and health and prosperity, a never-ending stream of fun and excitement and good things, and you're now on easy street. The road to health, wealth. And that's so false that Yahshua, the Messiah, even confirmed it himself many, many times. And those that teach this kind of rubbish are no better than those who sat in the temple making merchandise out of religion and Yahshua to throw them out. In John chapter 16, oh yeah, there are promises, but that doesn't mean we got the promises now. He never promises all our wants. He promises that our needs will be met. And that's what matters. The promises follow this life. They're not in this life necessarily. In fact, oftentimes it's just the opposite. These things have I spoken unto you. I'm in John 16, verse 33. These things have I spoken unto you, that in me you might have peace. In the world you shall have tribulation. No health, wealth, and prosperity there. But be of good cheer, I have overcome the world. People will persecute you, he said. They'll want to do to you what they did to me. They'll take you before the courts. They'll throw you in their prisons. They'll even take your life. Expect it. Prepare for it. Understand that it could easily happen. He says, get battle-hardened. Learn to overcome. Yahshua said, watch and pray. A constant refrain. Watch and pray that you'll be able to withstand the evil day. You know, I don't know if you ever, I remember growing up there was a particular hammer that I liked and I used all the time as a kid. And it said on there, drop forged. I didn't know what drop forged meant. I knew it meant it was hardened somehow. But it was only later that I learned that what they do to harden steel is they hammer it. And it gets all the molecules and everything lined up in a line and it makes it twice as strong. So they forge it. They bang it and bang it and bang it till it's strong. Sometimes that's how we feel. We're being drop forged all the time so that Yahweh will strengthen us. Well, Paul was battle hardened in Philippians chapter 4. He says, in effect, that he knows the ropes. He's been through it all. And if you look at this man, I think it's time for another Paul message. To look at actually what he went through. I mean, I don't know if Yahweh could have found anybody like him to undergo what he was chosen to do and still come through. This guy was something else. Anyway, in Philippians chapter 4, verse 12, it says, I know how to be abased, and I know how to abound. I know how to be knocked down, and I know how to prosper. Everywhere and in all things I am instructed both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. So that's kind of what I've been through. I know how to do all of that. I can do all things through Messiah, which strengthens me. Notwithstanding, you have well done that you did communicate with my affliction. So here's a man. He said, I can pretty much take it all. I'm just basically scar tissue at this point. I've been through so many things that, another one doesn't really bother me. Said he was strengthened by Yahshua, but he himself had to do the overcoming, didn't he? Yahweh gives us the help in time of need, but he doesn't take over. We don't go on autopilot. We don't suddenly just leave it up to him and just say, okay, here I am. We have to get through it. And then the real tests begin. And there are obstacles all over the place to overcome. There's spouses. There's family. There's employers. There's school administrators. Even friends. There's all sorts of obstacles to overcome. And we hear about them all the time, every day. You know, anytime you allow anyone to determine how you're going to live for Yahweh, you've just set up an idol. Anything that you allow to come between you and Yahweh is idolatry. You're allowing something to come between you and the one you worship. The wife says, I'm not going to the feast, and neither are you. And if you listen to her over the clear command of the word, then You're worshiping and serving an idol, not your creator. Employer says, we can't spare you in October. We need you. We need everyone that week. If you fear him more than Yahweh, then, you know, you cancel out and you just bow down to another idol. You know, talk is cheap and always has been. Action produces results. If we stand our ground and say, no, I'm going to obey my Father the way he has shown me to do, that's a different story. Then we're worshiping him honestly and truly. We can draw many lessons from our culture today. George Barna, who a couple of years ago directed a tracking study of religious beliefs and practices, noted that the relationship between people's perception of their religious commitment and their reluctance to live their faith as their top priority points to a significant disconnect, he says. He says, spirituality is in vogue in our society today. It's popular to claim to be part of a faith community or to have a spiritual commitment. But what do Americans mean when they claim to be, quote, spiritual? It seems as if Yahweh is in, but living for him is out. Many Americans are living a dual life, one filled with good feelings about Yahweh and faith, corroborated by some simple religious practices, and another in which they believe they are in control of their own destiny and operate apart from him. In other words, not walking your faith is what he's talking about. This guy who wrote 36 books on faith and culture says this: the survey noted that among those who say their faith has greatly transformed their life, just 1 out of 4 put their faith and pursuits as the highest in their priority of life. It certainly seems that millions are fooling themselves into thinking that they found the appropriate balance between religion and lifestyle. In fact, there is no balance. That's the thing. You can look at a Muslim out there. He's out there. He's bowing down 5 times to Mecca every day, and you know he lives by his Torah, by his Quran. There's no difference between his faith and his life. His faith is his life. Well, that's the way it used to be in the Bible too. Your faith was your life. And until they came along and said, "Well, we're going to separate religion from government," I think in people's minds they separate their faith from their life in that same way. The two aren't the same when they need to be the same. There's no balance there. Yahweh doesn't share you with the world. He doesn't allow his people to have a healthy commingling with the world. Well, yeah, you can do this, but you can only go so far. As if to shut off one light and turn on another one. It's all the same light. And Satan makes good things happen in false worship to keep people think that they're okay. That they're okay. Jeremiah chapter 44. Let's turn there. If we don't live our faith, then we don't have a faith worth living for. Jeremiah 44, verse 15. Then all the men who knew that their wives had burned incense unto other mighty ones, and all the women that stood by a great multitude, even all the people that dwelt in the land of Egypt, in Pathos answered Jeremiah, saying, as for the word which you have spoken unto us in the name of Yahweh, we will not hearken unto you, but we will certainly do whatever thing goes forth out of our own mouth, to burn incense unto the Queen of Heaven, and to pour out drink offerings unto her, as we have done we and our fathers and our kings and our princes in the cities of Judah and the streets of Jerusalem. For then we had plenty to eat, and we were well, and we saw no evil. But since we stopped burning incense to the Queen of Heaven and to pouring out drink offerings unto her, we have wanted all things and have been consumed by the sword and by the famine. Why do bad things happen to good people? Or good things happen to bad people, is the question here. Why do good things happen to bad people? To keep them sidetracked so they don't return to Yahweh. So they're not seeking for something better. They're happy where they are. And that's where most people are today. They're happy where they are. They don't want to change. Matthew chapter 7, verse 21. Not everyone that says unto me, Master, Master, shall enter into the kingdom of heaven, but he that does the will of my Father, which is in heaven. That's what he wants. These are the kind of people he wants into his kingdom. Well, the truth isn't for the weak. It's not for the undecideds. It's not for the unstable. Genesis chapter 49, verse 3, we see that Reuben didn't get the blessings as the others did. Why? Because even though he was firstborn of the 12 tribes, he was unstable. He sinned grievously. He didn't get the blessings. Spiritual stability in our world is even tougher. Satan has opened up a lot more fronts. Our entire earth is under his influence. The saints are always under assault, and in our personal lives, there is going to be times of persecution and true, severe trials. And so, subtly, we may compromise because we're caught between being different and being part of society, and everybody wants to fit in. Well, you know what? When it comes to the Bible, you don't fit in because the world is against the Bible. If the world was for the Bible, then we could all fit in, but it's not. It has a bias, an innate bias against anything that does not agree with its lifestyle. Well, we have problems in marriage, we have problems in families, we have struggles and dilemmas, and we look for solutions and resolutions, and we fight sin all the time. And the world is very powerful in its allurements, and the flesh is very weak and vulnerable to the evil one. It's very much a battle to stay in, committed to this truth, to this walk. Yahshua was always concerned about the stability of those who followed him. Paul was too, and Yahshua was concerned about even the strength of his disciples, as we said. I hope, Peter, once you get some strength, that you strengthen the rest of them. In Matthew chapter 10, he clearly warned them to anticipate difficulty. That's not the message we hear today, is it? We hear the message of downhill, easy street, once you accept the truth. He warned them about difficulties and trials. Anticipate trials, anticipate problems. He would repeatedly point out to them the weakness of their flesh. Their faith has to be stronger, wanting to, in many ways, to instruct and insulate them as well. He says, and when he had called unto him his 12 disciples, he gave them power against unclean spirits to cast them out and to heal and do all manner of sickness and all manner of disease, to heal all manner of these things. Now the names of the 12, and he lists them there. You want to good kind of forget who's who. There's a good list down to through verse 4. And then verse 5, these 12 Yahshua sent forth and commanded them, saying, Go not unto the way of the Gentiles, and into any city of the Samaritans enter ye not, but go rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And as you go, preach, saying, The kingdom of heaven is at hand. Heal the sick, cleanse the lepers, raise the dead, cast out devils. Freely you have received, freely give. These are kind of like the marching orders for his warriors to go out and battle the world and sin. So he says, provide neither gold nor silver nor brass in your purses, nor scrip for your journey, neither two coats, neither shoes, nor yet staves. For the workman is worthy of his meat. And into whatever city or town you shall enter, inquire who is worthy, and there abide till you go hence. And then when you come into a house, salute it. And if the house be worth it, let your peace come upon it. And if it not be worthy, let your peace return to you. And whosoever shall not receive you, nor hear your words when you depart out of that house or city, shake off the dust from your feet. Verily I say unto you, it shall be more tolerable for the land of Sodom and Gomorrah in the day of judgment and for that city. Interesting that there's still some hope for those people that committed such evilness, such as Sodom and Gomorrah. He says there's more hope for them than for those who have an understanding of the truth and reject it. Behold, I send you forth as sheep in the midst of wolves. Be therefore wise as serpents, but harmless as doves. Beware of men, for they will deliver you up to the councils, and they will scourge you in their synagogues. Now, this is talking about the religious people, not the average Joe out there. He doesn't do these things, but he said, watch out, because they're not going to like it. You shall be brought before governors and kings for my sake for a testimony against them and the Gentiles. But when they shall deliver you up, take no thought how or what you shall speak, for it shall be given unto you that same hour what you shall speak. For it is not you that speaks, but the Spirit of the Father which speaks in you. Very interesting set of instructions Yahweh gave to his people and the things that they should expect and go to and get out into the world. And so much of what we hear today is false. It doesn't measure up even to that. Let's look at Acts 22:19. I want to focus on verse 17 we just read. And Acts 22:19, notice something interesting. And I said, Master, they know that I am imprisoned and beat in every synagogue them that believed on thee. They beat in every synagogue them that believed on thee. We just talked about that at the Bible study. People think, well, just those people in the synagogues were the Jews. Well, first of all, synagogue is a Greek word, but there were Gentiles there too, and they believed on Yahshua. So they were both. They were both. People will explain away all these proofs of the Sabbath and all the verses in Acts telling of how Paul went to the synagogues on the Sabbath to preach by saying he was trying to convert Jews. Nonsense. There were already believers worshiping in connection to those synagogues, and they were doing it on the Sabbath. And believers were worshiping on the Sabbath too in the New Testament. That was all part of what the early assembly was all about. Who was an original, quote, Christian? I think that would be an excellent study. Who were they? Who did they work with? All they had was Jews at the start, wasn't it? Those who would accept Yahshua, the Messiah, as well as keep the commandments of the Old Testament. Matthew chapter 10, verse 18. And you shall be brought before governors and kings for my sake for a testimony against them and the Gentiles. What do you think the repercussions would be when you come to a leader, tell him he's doing wrong? What were the repercussions when John the Immerser told Herod, you can't have that woman as your wife? He immediately received retribution, didn't he? The swift reaction was to kill the messenger. Newsflash, brethren, people of hard hearts get angry when you tell them the truth. If you're truly following in Yahshua's footsteps, they're going to get angry at you too. Just expect it. Don't think of this as some strange new thing, as Yahshua said. They're not going to like it. So get ready for a life of testing. It's not easy, Yahshua said. But if you're not of the truth, you'll probably have health, wealth, and prosperity. Did Yahshua stand firm? Always. Always. Did he ever waver? Never. Did he ever compromise? No. Did he ever sin? No. He who knew no sin, the Bible describes as a perfect high priest. Perfect high priest. Yahshua then is the model, and he stood firm against all of the corruption, all of the antagonism, all of the negativism of the world he was in, and he stood firm and never violated once. Oh yeah, he was persecuted. He was through all sorts of trials, and he never did fall to pieces under those trials. He never collapsed. He never lost his confidence in his father and wandered around looking for his own solution or his own salvation. He always stood firm. Through the years, we've noticed many people who just become so confused they just can't handle it, just give up. All the conflicting doctrines, and they just say, well, if this person says this and that person says that, then nobody seems to know the truth. That's not the issue. The issue is, what does the Bible say? Go to the Bible and look it up. They were basing their convictions on what others were saying. Well, sure, there's going to be conflicts. Sure, there's going to be people say, well, it says one thing, another one says another. Look it up. Get into the Bible. Get into the Hebrew and the Greek words and find out what it really says. Encourage people to check it out. Don't listen to what someone else says. They're not going to be standing there. He says, when you come before Yahweh, it's going to be you and Yahweh, nobody else. You can't say, wait a minute, Pastor, come here, explain this to him for me, would you? Yahweh's going to say, no, Pastor, you explain it to me. Well, I wish I'd done some things differently, you might be saying. Ephesians 4:14 says you're going to be tossed and fro. Many will be tossed and fro with lots of winds of doctrines. One thing blows this way, they believe that, then it blows that way, they believe that. Many are like the Athenians in Acts 17 who spent their time just listening to the latest teaching. That was their hobby. Tell me something new. That's interesting. Didn't really resolve anything, but boy, they were sure interested in hearing the latest thing. I imagine sometimes some of that would stick. And, of course, they weren't involved in the truth anyway, so it didn't really matter. James said, a double-minded man is unstable in all his ways. We can't be double-minded. We have to decide what the truth says and then go with it until we're shown something more. Maybe there's a little different understanding that is a little more accurate. Then we go with that. We walk in all the light we're given. We don't stop. We don't say, I can't understand any of that, just throw it all up. So how can we be stable? How can we stand firm against trials? How can we handle this life we've been given? The ups and downs and so forth. James chapter 1, 23 is a key. And I want to probably, well, we're getting close to the end. I don't know how much time we have left. James 1, 23. Here's on the screen if you want to read it. For if any be a hearer of the word and not a doer, he is like unto a man beholding his natural face in a glass. For he beholds himself and goes his way and straightway forgets what manner of man he was. But whoso looks into the perfect law of liberty and continues therein, he being not a forgetful hearer but a doer of the work, this man shall be blessed in his deed. Not just talk about it, but do it. You know, you don't learn something until you do it. We're learning a new program at work, and it's difficult. But you know, you don't learn it. You can sit around and listen to all 1,000 professors talk about it until you get in there and start manipulating it, and you're not going to learn it. You're not going to learn it like you need to learn it. You can easily become unstable and start compromising when you're one thing isolated from others. We hear a lot of from a lot of people say, man, I wish I had fellowship to strengthen me. It's all about brethren holding up other brethren. It's all about bouncing something off somebody else. He says, no. Have you looked at this? Oh, no, I never saw it that way. And then it refines this new idea that you have. Till you get, you know, if you don't do that, you get way out in left field, and pretty soon, who knows, you can get so far out. That's part of what an assembly does. It also holds you accountable. You get stability with the body of Messiah. You can serve others, and that's the best way to grow spiritually, is by serving others, because you help yourself more than you actually help them. No opportunity to learn humility by taking correction at times if you don't have a body of Messiah to work within. You become stagnated. You become stale sometimes if you're not constantly being fed meat. in an assembly of learned and knowledgeable individuals who can, you know, basically handle any subject thrown at them, you have a litmus test. Is this really true? Is this what the Bible really says? Well, let's find out. Let's study it out. You know, I could teach that Yahshua's married and had two children and put it on a website tonight, and I have people agreeing with me tomorrow morning in email. There's so many different wacky ideas out there, and you have to be sound, you have to be firm, you have to be grounded. Because there are not only those who are just looking like the Athenians for something new and different, but there are those who out there who simply want to find something that they believe is more truth than another, and they'll grab onto it without fully studying it and going through the hard work of proving something according to doctrine, according to Scripture, according to all the rest of the Bible. And that's all part of it too. But let's remember, when we're under trial and tribulation, there's a reason for it. We're not just, because some divine fiat has decided to just let us have a little difficulty. It's because Yahweh is giving us a reason to allow us to strengthen, to allow us to overcome. Because one day we're going to have to. We're going to have to be built up and hardened, drop forged, and ready to go when the real tests come. And those tests are coming. And these little things that we endure every day simply are training ground for something far greater. So let's pray Almighty Yahweh that He keeps us strong at these times. We can overcome one day to be greeted by Yahshua. Welcome into life everlasting. May Yahweh bless you.